Hi, this is Josh Cook. Thank you for downloading the North Jackson Church of Christ sermon audio file. If you have any questions or would like to contact us, check out our website at northjacksonchurchofchrist.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in our worship service. You're always welcome at North Jackson Church of Christ.
Good evening. Adam, James, and Randy, thank you for getting us off to such a great start this evening. Is it possible that one of the worst days in our lives could actually turn out to be one of the best days in our lives? Let's talk about it. It was the fall of 1988. Katie and I were working with the congregation here. We had just started. We were living here in Jackson near Jack and Mary Frances Christie and Jack and Susie Summers. We loved the work here. Katie was about 20 months old. I came home one afternoon about 5:30 in the evening. I had just left coaching at Jackson Christian School. And through the window, as I pulled up into the driveway, I noticed that Kathy was seated in the recliner. And she had her bathrobe on. Both were incredibly unusual. Kathy wouldn't be wearing her bathrobe at 5:30 in the afternoon, nor would she be in the recliner. Usually she was busy getting supper prepared. I can't really remember what Katie was doing. But when I walked in the door, she'd been crying, and I knew that was unusual too, because she just really doesn't cry that much. She was holding something in her lap in tissue paper, and I didn't know what that was. She'd had a miscarriage. She was about 12 weeks along. I remember the day she told me that we were going to have another baby, and I was so excited, and I told everyone at Jackson Christian School, all of my coaching buddies, that I was going to be a father again, and we wanted a boy, and our parents wanted us to have a boy, and then I come home, and she's lost a baby, and doctors tell us he just didn't develop. It was a little boy. It was one of the hardest days of my life. I don't believe I've ever really questioned God. I didn't question him when I lost my dad. I didn't question him when I lost my mother. I didn't question him when we lost Kathy's dad, whom I considered as my own father. But I questioned him then. Why would my son be taken? There would be two more miscarriages after that. And then 4 years later, we would have Nathan. And Kathy was so strong. She's such a strong person. Much stronger than I am. And she comforted me, and I should have been the one comforting her. And she told me that in heaven there were three babies waiting for us. And I'll never forget the day she told me, had it not been for those three miscarriages, we might have never had Nathan. We probably would have quit. We wouldn't have gone on and had more children. We probably would have stopped with five. Or four, rather. We wouldn't have had five. And I never really thought about it that way. And it dawned on me that one of the worst days in my life had actually turned out to be one of the greatest days, happiest days in my life. I can't imagine life without Nathan. That name means a gift from God, and that's exactly what he was and who he is. Joseph had a number of bad days in his life. Losing his mother was probably the worst day in his life. Running a close second would be this day that happened to him in Genesis 37. Now, the last time we were together, we talked about Jacob, whose name would be changed to Israel. That would be the designated name for God's people. That tells you something about Jacob and his character. I know we said some things about Jacob last week, the ups and downs of his faith journey, and I know Jacob made a lot of mistakes in his life, but he did a lot of things well, and God loved him, and God used him, and he was one of the forefathers of the Hebrew faith. And as a matter of fact, when Moses is standing at the burning bush, in Exodus 3, you'll remember that God introduced himself as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. In Matthew 8, verse 11, when Jesus talked about sitting at the banquet table of God in heaven, he said we would be seated there with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God wasn't ashamed to call Jacob his son. Jacob was a great man, faults and all. We can't really understand or appreciate Joseph if we don't know a little bit about his parents. And everything that we don't find in Jacob, we certainly find in Joseph. And with Joseph, you see a cycle broken, and you see a man who trusted God from an early age. And I know we talked a week before that about how difficult his family was and his brothers, and they're not very nice in this chapter at all, but they were good men, and God used them in incredible ways. For example, Levi would become the tribe of Levi, and the Levites then would become God's priest. Judah, who's involved with this, will be the one through whom the Messiah someday would come. And so God, in spite of all of their faults, in spite of all of their mistakes, would not have his plans altered, and he used imperfect people for his perfect plans. I find hope in that. I find comfort in that. That with all of my imperfections, God can still love me, God can still use me, and I can find a place in his kingdom, and that he has a purpose for my life. And I loved what James said in his prayer tonight. I may not know what that purpose is. I sometimes don't know what it is, but God does. And so you leave it all in his hands, and you trust him, and he unfolds his plan for your life. That's the story of Joseph. He's the hero of our story as we continue our study of his great life. Tonight, I want us to think about the betrayal of Joseph by his brothers, and I want us to unpack the 37th chapter of Genesis, beginning with verse 12, as we think about, first of all, Israel's request. Back up to verse 12, notice 12 through 14. Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." Then he said to him, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. First of all, notice the place. It's Shechem. And Israel has sent his sons, with the exception of Joseph. Joseph is his favorite, remember? But he has sent them to Shechem, which is several miles away, about 48 miles away, to feed the sheep, to graze the sheep. And Shechem is a delicate situation because, remember, Shechem in Genesis 34 is where Simeon and Levi attacked all the males there, the men there, and slaughtered all the men there. And so now Israel has sent his sons and flocks to Shechem. Some time has passed, we think. And so could it be that the Shechemites are going to rise up in retaliation and kill his sons and maybe rob him of his flocks? And so he needs someone to go and check on his sons and the flocks in Shechem. That would be Joseph. And it is amazing, the response of Joseph, and we'll note that in a minute. But think with me about this, because this plays a role, I think, in Joseph's response, the amazing part of it at least, the past performance of Israel's sons. You'll go back to verse 2 and notice that Joseph brought an evil report about his brothers. And we learned that that Hebrew word entails the idea of something that is known throughout the neighborhood, that's known in the area, we might say. It is a bad sin. It's something that the father, Israel, needed to know about his sons. Joseph brought that report to his father, but that tells you something about his brothers. And so here is Jacob. He sent them to Shechem. He knows their past. He knows what they've done in the past. So he's concerned. It's also been too quiet. They've been gone so long, it's been so quiet, he wonders what they're up to. It's kind of like with our children. We know that when our children get too quiet, something's up. We need to check on them. And I think Joseph knew, or Jacob rather, knew what his past was like. And it was very true that his sons were very much like him. And so he knew what he might do if he were that far away from home. And so he wanted to check on them. And so he will send Joseph to do that. That then leads us to Joseph's response. In verses 15 through 17, you'll notice the courage of the response of Joseph here, where Joseph responds to his father in verse 13, "Here I am." It's very similar to Isaiah 6, verse 8, where God said to Isaiah, "Who can we send?" And Isaiah said, "Here I am, send me." Joseph had that kind of feeling or attitude toward his father. But this is a courageous step on the part of Joseph, isn't it? Because Joseph knows he isn't popular with his brothers. He knows that his brothers hate him. He knows that his brothers don't care for him. And so for him to leave the security of his father in the valley of Hebron and travel all the way to Shechem by himself and check on his brothers there as they're grazing the flock was setting himself up for sure disaster. And his fears were well founded because we know the rest of the story. So it took a lot of courage for him to leave in the first place. But secondly, notice his complete obedience. Again, if you'll notice in verse 14, Jacob or Israel says, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks." Then listen to verse 15. "Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?' So he said, 'I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks.' And the man said, 'They have departed from here, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan.' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan." First of all, Shechem is 50 miles from Hebron. He's traveled that. He'll go 13 extra miles to Dothan. So he is intent on doing what his father wanted. But what did his father want? Did his father just want him to go to Shechem? Because he could have gone to Shechem, not found them there, and come back home and said, "Father, I've been to Shechem. They're not there." But is that what his father really asked him to do? His father asked him to go to Shechem, check on his brothers and on the flocks. So he knows his father's heart. He knows what his father really wants. And so what does he do? He doesn't stop until he finishes the project, finishes the mission. He then goes on to Dothan because his task is to check on the welfare of his brothers and the safety of the flocks. You see, with Joseph, he thought of reasons to complete his mission, not reasons to abandon it. I can see sending Nathan to Shechem, my son, and telling him, "Check on your brothers and check on the flocks." And Nathan coming back to me and saying, "Well, they're not in Shechem." And believing he had done exactly what he was supposed to do. And I'd have to look at him and say, "Well, son, that's not what I said to you. I wanted you to check on your brothers. Did you do that?" "No." "Well, do you know where your brothers are?" "Well, yeah, but they weren't in Shechem." Joseph went the extra mile. He not only went to Shechem, but when he didn't find them there, he goes on to Dothan. I don't know who this man is, this stranger is, but he plays a part in the life of Joseph and in the providence of God. That's just how God does things. But I am impressed by the courage of Joseph going and not hesitating, and then the completeness of his obedience to his father. Now the brothers' reception. We start at verse 18 with their plot. They plot against Joseph, and in today's vernacular, what they're plotting is premeditated murder. Look at verse 18. "Now when they saw him afar off, even before they came near them, before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. So their first response is, we're going to kill him. Now, Reuben is going to intervene, but their first reaction is, they're going to kill him. Now, how did they know it was Joseph? They see him at a distance. How do they know it's Joseph? It could have been someone else. Well, what gave Joseph away was the very reason they hated Joseph, his coat of many colors. What that reminded them of was the fact that he was their father's favorite son. And what Joseph received from their father, they did not receive, and that was their father's love. That's the way favoritism works. One gets the love, the other does not. And they knew in Joseph, he was the signified heir of his father. And this is how that works. It was Reuben who was Leah's firstborn son, correct? He was the firstborn, the oldest. He should have gotten his father's blessing. But he's discredited because he slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah, and disgraced himself. And so then you turn to Rachel. And who was Rachel's firstborn son? Joseph. He's the rightful heir. And of course, they hate him because of his dreams, and he had shared those dreams with them. So they plot to put him to death. And it is a cruel death that they intend. And then you see Reuben's proposal. Look at verse 22, or 21, back up. But Reuben heard it and delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it, and they sat down to eat a meal. Did you notice the last part of that? And so their plot is to kill him. They're going to throw him into a pit, most likely a cistern, a well that's dry. These were reservoirs in the desert of water, and they sustained life with these, but many of them were empty. Archaeologists have found many of these cisterns. You read about them all throughout the Old Testament, but they've discovered many of these cisterns, and in them they have found skeletons. So this wasn't a novel approach to taking someone's life. But Reuben appears to have every intention of getting him out of there, and someone has to ask, why in the world would he do that? Is it possible that Reuben is not as cruel as his brothers are? I don't think that's it. I think what is plaguing Reuben is he's the oldest, and as the oldest, whose responsibility is it to make sure the youngest gets back home to daddy? It is Reuben, and Reuben feels that responsibility keenly, and so he says, let's don't kill him. Let's throw him into the pit. Now, if someone doesn't get him out of the pit, he's certainly going to die in the pit anyway. But let's throw him in there, and I think Reuben has every intention of coming back and getting him out of the pit and taking him back to his father. I don't think it's because he's a great person or a good person or much better than his brothers. I think it's because his brother's safety is on him. Later on, in chapter 42, verse 37, when it comes to Benjamin leaving the side of his father Israel and going to Egypt, you'll recall that Reuben said to Israel, look, if I don't bring him back to you, you can kill my two sons. In other words, the name of Reuben would be wiped out from the face of the earth. He's saying, you can take my name and obliterate it if I don't bring your son Benjamin back to you. Reuben did bring Benjamin back. I think Reuben realized the importance of getting his brother back to his father. Then Judah's plan. One more thing. One thing that is so sad to me is, again, the end, the first of verse 25, where they cast him into the pit, and then a few feet from him, what do? They sit down and eat a meal. And what is Joseph doing then while all of this is taking place? And Joseph is so pleading for his life. Look over at Genesis 42. This is looking back on the story, and this is something that the brothers add to the narrative. But look at Genesis 42, verse 21. This is how Joseph responded to being thrown in the pit and his brothers eating a meal nearby him. Then they said to one another, this is the brothers now, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." And so he pleaded for his life. They don't listen. As a matter of fact, they sit down and eat a meal. Someone once said, "With what heart could they say grace?" And someone has described their hatred in this way: hatred is a boomerang that harms the hater the most. And it had come full circle. And so that is the plan, Reuben's suggestion. Now look at Judah's plan. Look at verses 25 to 28. We read the rest of 25. "Then they lifted up their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him. Listen, for he is our brother and our flesh.'" That did not stop them from plotting to kill him or wanting to throw him into the pit, which they ended up doing, or sitting down and eating a meal while he is crying for his life. But he is our flesh. He is our brother, but they betray him. And his brothers listened. Then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Let me ask you something. How heartless do you have to be to actually barter with Ishmaelite traders for your brother? He's standing right there. He's listening to everything you're saying, and you're going back and forth on a price for your own brother. They sold their own brother for 20 shekels of silver. Someone estimated that to be a mere $9. But Judah is the materialistic brother. Why kill him? Let's make some money off of him. You know who else did that? Who else was materialistic and was willing to sell out someone, his brother, for 30 pieces of silver? Judas. How heartless do you have to be as brothers to do something like this to your own flesh and blood? And may I remind us, Joseph is 17 years old. 17. Not 47, not 67, not 107, but 17 years old. What goes through a 17-year-old's mind when his brothers are mistreating him the way they are mistreating him? How heartless do you have to be to do what they have done? And then notice Reuben's panic. For some reason, Reuben is not with them, and Reuben has perhaps gone to see after the flock. When he comes back, he's stunned, horrified to see that Joseph is gone. Again, I think it's because his responsibility is to bring Joseph back, and he has failed. And he has failed his father before. But listen, there will be no greater failure in the eyes of his father than allowing his favorite son to go missing, or worse yet, to die. And so Reuben is panicking in verse 29. "Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes in anguish. And he returned to his brothers and said, 'The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?'" And as you read the rest of the story of Reuben, his father did not think very highly of him. If you go to Genesis 49, when Israel is dying and he blesses his sons, I want you to listen to what he says to his firstborn Reuben. This is firstborn son now. His firstborn son. Here's what he says. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water. You shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Now he's referring to Genesis 35, 21 and 22, when Reuben slept with his father's concubine. But you see what Joseph or what Jacob is saying to Reuben here is, you are as unstable as water. I cannot trust you with my blessing. The fact that Reuben, I think, felt guilt about what happened to his brother the rest of his life is evident in chapter 22 or 42, verse 22. Listen, and Reuben answered them saying, did I not speak to you saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Therefore, his blood is now required of us. And so I think Reuben lived the rest of his life with the guilt of knowing that he had let his father down. So you have the brothers' reception and what they did with Joseph. They didn't kill him, but they did just as bad. They sold him, and now he's gone. He's no more, as Reuben said. Now, finally, look at the results, the false report. Look at verse 31. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? And he recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Now, this is his son. This is his favorite son. This is the son of Rachel. They waited so long for him to come. And Israel now is realizing, I'm never going to see him again. Then Jacob tore his clothes, this time in mourning, put on sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. This is going to kill me. This is going to kill me. That's how I feel about losing my son, Joseph. Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Notice, first of all, the purposeful deceit that goes on here. Is it not interesting that these brothers deceived their father in the very same way that their father had deceived his father? You remember back in Genesis 27, in verse 16, when Jacob stole the blessing from his brother Esau, do you remember how he did it? With the skins of a goat. This is the blood of a goat. But oh, how Jacob, if he could put two and two together, must have realized in agony later on what his sons had done and how it had come back to haunt him. In the Old Testament, it's very easy to note that the sins of the father are repeated by the sins of the sons in so many cases. And it's horrible how these brothers deceived, or treated rather, their own brother, but then how they deceived their father because they told him a lie, they allowed him to believe a lie, and for 30 years he mourned his son. Who does that? Who lies to your father and then watches him just wilt away and die, thinking you'll never see his son again, when you know full well that he's not dead, that you sold him to Ishmaelite traders, and he may very well still be alive. And for all of those years, they comfort him as if Joseph were dead. How heartless Do you have to be? And yet, through Levi will come the Levitical order of priests, the high priest Aaron, and through the tribe of Judah will come the Messiah. Don't tell me God isn't great, and God isn't good, and God's grace is greater than all our sin, because it is. And then notice Jacob's remorse. The fact that this stayed with Joseph is, or Jacob rather, is very evident. Go to chapter 44. There are two places where the Holy Spirit records the way that Jacob felt many, many, many years later about the loss of his son. He never got over it. How do you get over the loss of a child? You don't. You never do. Look at verses 27 through 29 of Genesis 44. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore two sons. You see what he's thinking about? And the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, referring to Benjamin, the other son of Rachel, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. I think his hair became grave because of grief. But even years later, he is still mourning the loss of his son. And someone says, you know, it's hard for me to mourn with him. He's only reaping what he sowed. My response to that is, where is our compassion? Can you not feel his grief and his pain, and he has been deceived in every way? And don't you know he's blaming himself, because who sent him to Shechem? He did. I can't imagine how he felt and how that must have hurt him. And then to realize later, his sons happened to be behind it all, and then he grieved again at the pitiful spiritual state of his own sons. That's the life of Jacob. There are three messages I'd like to take from this lesson tonight. Number one, the power of envy. If you go over to Acts 7 and Stephen's sermon, this is why they did what they did to Joseph. This is the power of envy. Hatred fuels envy. Twice in this story, it's said that the brothers hated Joseph, and that hatred turned to envy, and that envy turned to murder. In a sense, look at verse 9. And the patriarchs becoming envious sold Joseph into Egypt. I love this. But God was with him and delivered him out of all his troubles and gave him favor and wisdom in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he made him governor over Egypt and all his house. And so you see, out of envy, they delivered Joseph and tried to get rid of Joseph. It was envy that caused Cain to kill Abel. It was envy that caused Saul to chase David and try to kill him numerous times. It was envy that kept the older brother from the younger brother in the story of the prodigal son. And it was envy that caused antagonistic Jews to Jesus to rise up and crucify him. Envy is like acid. It not only destroys the container, but it also destroys the one upon which it is cast. The power of envy. Two, the penalty of sin. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. The truth is, there's always a penalty to be paid for sin. Someone always pays a price. In this story, in the very beginning, it's Joseph, because he's thrown into a pit. He's left there to die. He's then sold into slavery. He's betrayed by his brothers. And so he reaps the consequences of the sins of others. And then you have the price that Jacob paid, believing his son to be dead for 30 years. That had to have been agonizing for him. Someone pays for sin, but you know who pays the most for sin? The sinner. Because later on, who is it that's saying, his blood now is upon us? It is none other than the one who was responsible for Joseph from the beginning, and that is Reuben. And then finally, note the providence of God. You meant it for evil, God meant it for good. That's the calling card of the story of Joseph. There's an old legend that tells a story of Joseph on his way to Egypt. And as he's on his way to Egypt, somehow he manages to escape his captors. But as he's escaping, a dog barks. And his captors realize that he's trying to get away, and so they recapture him. And they eventually then take him on to Egypt. And how Joseph perhaps loathed that dog barking and catching him. Well, in a book entitled Man Without a Country by Everett Edward Hale, he takes that tale or that legend and he spins it a little bit different and he asks this question. Suppose that dog hadn't barked. Suppose Joseph does get away, he goes back home, they enjoy 7 years of plenty, but what do you do when the 7 years of famine come upon you? There was no one in Egypt to store the grain during the 7 plentiful years, so during the 7 famine years, and those years when it was so bad, there was no bread in all of Egypt or Canaan, and the whole human race is wiped out because one dog didn't bark. Notice again with me in chapter 37 what the brothers hoped to accomplish when they put Joseph in the pit. Note again, this is fueled from their hatred. Look at verse 19 one more time. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." And boy, did they ever see what would become of their dreams. But what they believed would put an end to his dreams only gave his dreams life. God did that. And if God can do that in a life, in a situation, in trials like this, just think what he can do in our lives when we suffer a miscarriage or we suffer the illness of a child or even the loss of a child or some other horrific event in our lives, like a struggle of some kind, maybe with illness. When we go through difficulties like that, realize that maybe what seems to be the worst day of our lives may very well turn out to be one of the best days of our lives because of the providence of God. God has a plan for every man's life, every person's life. He had one for Joseph, and Joseph had to figure it out over time, but he does. Now, do we understand God has a plan for us? And that plan begins with obeying the gospel. So what do we do now? If you're not a Christian, will you become one? If you are a Christian but an unfaithful Christian, will you come back? I know it's not easy to do either one. And it wasn't easy for Joseph in that pit to think, why did they do that? Or for him to think when they sold him to Ishmaelite traders, why did they do that? Why did that dog bark? If that dog hadn't barked, I'd have gotten away. But you see, God had a greater plan, and God has a greater plan for you and me. And this evening, if you're ready to start that journey with him, we encourage you to come while together we stand and sing.